South Dakotans often say they want common sense solutions to the state's challenges. The people who represent our interests in meeting those challenges are South Dakotans themselves. This week, we introduce you to some of the decision makers in our government, people with the power to get stuff done. Heather Dawn Thompson is a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. She's been named the new director of the Office of Tribal Relations for the Biden administration. Thompson reports directly to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. I sat down with Thompson via Zoom on her second day in the role to talk about her work on behalf of tribal nations.
Tell us a little bit about, one of the reasons this is a big announcement is because it is a change from previous administrations in the structure of this position and who it reports to. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
You bet. So, as you know, the federal government has a nation-to-nation relationship and responsibility with tribal nations. They are not signatories to the Constitution, and so they are not participants in our democracy in the same way that states are. And therefore, the federal agencies need to have some sort of direct line, of communication with tribal nations. And unfortunately, this Office of Tribal Relations at the USDA had been moved under more of a public participation office and sort of demoted that government-to-government communication. And so under this secretary, thankfully, it's being moved back, and I report directly to the Secretary of the United States Department of Agriculture.
Tell us a little bit about what you know at this point, and it's early, about what Secretary Vilsack's priorities are and how they will relate to your office.
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the things that really drew me to serving under this secretary is, one, he has a proven history and track record in Indian country. He actually was the secretary that elevated this office in the first place and ensured that it had sufficient budget to serve Indian country. And then moving forward, the administration and Secretary Vilsack have made clear what their top four priorities are, which is economic recovery, addressing and ending the pandemic, climate change, and racial equity. And frankly, you're not going to find anywhere in the United States where those four issues converge more than in Indian country. So I'm just really delighted to be working with the Secretary to address those directly in Indian country.
We have heard from this administration, virtually every spokesperson in every meeting is mentioning that word equity and giving specifics about what that means in the context of whatever topic they're talking about. In the context of the USDA and your role, talk about equity and what that really means, because that seems like an incredible challenge starting from where we're at to where we really want to go.
I can talk about really concrete components of that and things and conversations that we've already had. I mean, this is my second day on the job. But as you know, tribal nations are just different. They're structured differently. Their economic development is different. And if your agency doesn't take that into account, you're not going to have access. And so you would be treated differently than a non-tribal entity that is applying for resources with the USDA, and not fairly. So I'll give you an example. As you know, tribal governments don't have a tax base. And so in order to create their revenue, they have to participate in a private marketplace. They own casinos, as many people know. They own gas stations. They own golf courses. They own hotels. And that's how they finance and run their government. So those tribal corporations are wholly owned by the government. They're a hybrid, right? They are governmental entities. They're revenue generators. They're essentially the Department of the Treasury for that tribal nation, but they are also participating in the private marketplace. USDA has historically had very strong delineations between a governmental project and program and a private practice, private industry project and program. And here you have a hybrid that fits neither. And so for many projects and programs and loans and grants, tribal governments have just simply been ineligible because the definitions did not include them. So I think that's a very concrete example of systemic impediments that end up creating racial inequalities, not purposefully, right? But you need to be really thoughtful. You need to have somebody who's an expert in federal Indian law to help the secretary work through those impediments and straighten them up.
Yeah. that is something that you bring to the table, and I think a lot of people in South Dakota understand, you know, you're Harvard-educated, Carnegie Mellon, I think University of Florida, is that correct? Bush Foundation Fellow, all these things. Tell us, though, for people who don't know you a little bit, what you're bringing to the table at USDA from the nation-to-nation conversation, from the tribal law experience. How do you kind of give that elevator speech to those who don't know Heather Dawn Thompson yet?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, which in itself is not, you know, a qualification, but it does mean that I know my own nation, I know my own community, and I've spent my time learning that and coming up through those methods. But in addition, you know, I've been a practicing lawyer. I'm going to tip my hat on my age for 20 years. In Indian country. So I have represented tribal governments on and off in different capacities for 20 years. And one of the most important aspects of my work with tribal nations, because I have lived in D.C. historically in the past, and I do know it pretty well, the system. Nobody knows it that well. But so I provide that opportunity of communication to facilitate that diplomatic relationship between tribes and federal governments. So I have served as a tribal advocate, tribal governmental advocate, and specifically tribal economic development lawyer and advocate for 20 years. And I think that it reflects very well on Secretary Vilsack that he's been willing to bring somebody of that caliber up to work with him on these issues.
One of the things you've joined us on this program to talk about before is your work with The Inconvenient Truth, the history behind the Rapid City Indian Boarding School and lands. And from my perspective, that has seemed like a process of intense and comprehensive research on your part, then the education and the community outreach, the bringing people together to have really complicated and sometimes uncomfortable conversations, followed by action and policy change, which is a direction that we don't normally get to that point in many of these issues. Sometimes there'll be an effective dialogue, but we won't see anything real and meaningful change. How does the work that we recognize you for with that project apply to the work that you might do with the USDA? Are there parallels to some of that process work?
I think so. Obviously, I think being a good attorney and a good policy advocate, you have to know what you're talking about. And you have to be very careful to do your research and get the experience before you speak on it. And so I'm going to take what we did in the Rapid City Indian Boarding School project and bring that with me to USDA. But I think more importantly for us here in South Dakota is the bipartisan nature of those conversations. And I think you're going to see that reflected in this USDA and specifically in the Office of Tribal Relations. Agricultural issues, rural economic development issues, tribal issues, frankly, they're just not partisan issues. They're American issues. And we always like to say in Indian country, we're eyes for indigenous. And I think that's one of the most important things I can bring to the table. Because in Indian country, as we know, we have native and non-native. My father's non-native. My mother's non-native. We all live together. We live together on the reservation. We live together off the reservation. And our rural economies need to rise as a whole. And I think one thing that we have not experienced yet in South Dakota that I'm hopeful for is in other states where rural tribal economies have succeeded, the entire rural region around it has succeeded. In some cases, they are the most and the biggest employer in the entire region. Tribal governments have some competitive advantages that our state and local governments don't, that we as a team, as a whole state, as a whole community need to take advantage of, so that our entire region rises up.
You also mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic, and we know how much we're just beginning to understand how much has already been lost, especially with elders in Indian country and language and traditions and culture. It is an urgent need for vaccinations and mitigation strategies still. Tell us a little bit about how to meet that urgency. What are some of the challenges that you see ahead, and how do you see this administration really rising to that occasion? When what we're hearing is that the administration, as they come in, have found the vaccine distribution process, for example, to be in far worse shape than they imagined. Tell us a little bit about the challenge ahead of you regarding the pandemic in rural areas particularly, and if this administration is ready to meet that challenge.
Absolutely. You know, as I shared, I'm on day two, but already I've had two COVID meetings. There are daily COVID meetings at USDA, which might surprise someone, right? You think, how does this relate to USDA? But you just put the nail on the head. You know, in rural America, we are not being addressed as quickly as we need. And in Indian country, it's not just urgent, it's an emergency. I mean, we're losing an entire generation. And as you pointed out, these are our Googles. They are our encyclopedias. And this information doesn't exist anywhere else other than in their hearts and in their minds, and it's irreplaceable. I think what is really interesting about the USDA and what I'm hoping that they can bring to the table is USDA has hundreds of rural offices. We have hundreds of veterinarians that have offices and refrigeration and the ability to administer doses that has not been taken advantage of. And that is the one thing that has really impressed me about this secretary and this office, is that immediately they are putting forward all of their resources that they have in rural America that make it more available to rural Americans.
Are there other thoughts that you want to make sure that people understand about how this position is changing and how people can make those connections with their rural USDA offices? What kinds of things do those offices serve? For people who don't know, how do they reach out and make those connections?
Absolutely. I think that you'll find that the Office of Tribal Relations website on the USDA is a really good place to start. One of the things that on the outside that I have noticed in working for tribal nations is that there is not a full appreciation of the breadth of what USDA does. If you just take South Dakota, for example, their definition of rural at USDA is under 50,000 in a town. So that's pretty much everywhere in our town, you know, in our state, mm-hmm. other than Rapid City and Sioux Falls. So all of our communities and all of our tribal communities, for the most part, are eligible for USDA programs. And I think there's a large misperception that it is just for our farmers. And while, of course, our farmers are so important to South Dakota and to our economy, USDA finances electricity, energy, telecom, broadband, water, water infrastructure, and they have an entire program just for rural business people. Small business people in rural areas, about 99% of South Dakota, are eligible for these low or no interest loans to be able to get their business back up and running. So that's what I'm really hoping to share, and I'm looking forward to advocating, is that there's just so much more available for South Dakota and the rest of Indian country and rural America than I think we realize at the USDA.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, one more question, because you also mentioned climate change, and that ties in many people's minds to Keystone XL, which has now been paused. That construction in South Dakota has been paused, and people are wondering what's next with that. Can you tell us anything about what happens next with Keystone XL?
I do not know specifically about Keystone XL because that's not within the purview of the USDA, but climate change as a whole, of course, is a top priority for our office and the USDA, and I think, you know, South Dakotans, for example, we work with the land differently than people in other states. We hunt, we fish, we farm, we ranch. We, better than anybody, understand the importance of maintaining our water sources, maintaining good climate, making sure that the storms are not destroying our crops. I think there's a really good synergy in moving forward in a modern way together to make sure that we can preserve our rural way of life in South Dakota.
You're an outdoor adventurer yourself, right?
I am.
Well, we appreciate you spending time with us today. Come back anytime for the listeners of South Dakota. We'll be right here for you. Heather, it's nice to see you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care.
You can see that full conversation on the In the Moment YouTube page or go to sdtv.org. U.S. Senator Mike Rounds recently voted to confirm General Lloyd Austin as the next U.S. Secretary of Defense. Rounds serves on the Armed Services Committee, and he's chair of the Subcommittee on Cybersecurity. I talked with him about cyber attacks on the U.S. and also his thoughts on challenges facing Congress regarding big tech companies in America. Lots to talk about. Senator Rounds, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori, and I do appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this afternoon.
I'm hoping we can start with cybersecurity, because before Christmas and around the election time, some of that news got buried with other things that were happening about cyber attacks on the U.S., and you were hoping to learn more and really share more after the holidays with people. What can you tell us today about some of those cyber attacks, what we know about them now?
I think a lot of it has been identified as the SolarWinds cyber attack. What we do know, and at least what we believe, and we have pretty good evidence of it, is that, you know, Russia and Russia-associated actors were behind it. And what they were doing was trying to gather information. As near as we can tell, they were not trying to damage things. They were in looking. They did not intend to be caught. They were in trying to get into as many different systems as possible, and they focused a lot of their attention on government systems. Now, we have different kinds of government systems. We have classified systems that are private, that are you know, not accessible. And then you also have the systems such as what we call the DoDEN, or the Defense Department Network, very similar to what you find in other agencies of government. The Department of Transportation has a system. The Department of Commerce has a system. Secretary of State's got a system. All of those different locations that most of us can just simply go with the .gov on it. You can get in and you can look around. Well, it's pretty obvious they were into a lot of those. What has not been discussed publicly is whether or not they were into any of the classified sections. And at this point, it does not appear, from what I'm aware of, or at least that what I've learned, it doesn't appear that they got into, or at least they haven't been found in any of the classified ones. But that doesn't mean that they weren't trying. And once again, you always have to be careful about suggesting that you know everything about what they're doing. And so I guess the message is they were in, they were looking around, they were not trying to destroy things, they were trying to gather information and figure out ways to get deeper into those networks. They did it using outside software that is relied upon software, and it was caught by another outside software firm. And it was shared fairly quickly. They didn't keep it quiet. They immediately shared it, which allowed for patches to be put into place to stop it from happening again. That's about as far as I can really go on it right now, and I suspect that a lot of that information is probably not new information to anybody that's been following it.
Tell me a little bit about the new Secretary of Defense and a new Biden administration and whether or not they will focus on cybersecurity in ways that are different or more expansive or less expansive than the Trump administration? What are you seeing so far in the early days of Biden's administration?
Yeah, let me go back a little bit farther, and let me go into the Obama administration to begin with. And remember, as cyber is being developed, we learn as we move through. And so I don't mean this to be a derogatory towards the Obama administration, but we learned some lessons about what happened during the time period as we became more adept at cyber. And what we had discovered was that during the time in which the Obama administration was in, they had created classified documents that gave directions about how cyber could be utilized. And it was called PPD 20, Presidential Policy Directive 20. That particular one was their best effort at trying to regulate and to separate out, so that we weren't stepping on each other, the different agencies of government and approval processes for allowing us to get outside of a war zone and to get in and to do offensive cyber operations. It did not work. And what we discovered was that over a period of 5 years, the individuals within the Department of Defense that were responsible for doing offensive cyber operations to slow down the guys who are out there trying to get into our stuff, that are literally throwing shooting the arrows at us, we didn't have one single offensive cyber operation successfully attempted during that five-year period of time because of the approval process and how difficult it was and how many different areas of government could negate or veto the operation and the time frame it took to actually work through. I do give credit to John Bolton and to members of the Trump team who listened to us when we went in and sat down and explained to them what we were discovering in our oversight capacity as a subcommittee on the Armed Services Committee, specifically with regard to cybersecurity. And our recommendation in conversations with them was you need to change and streamline this process. A new classified document was prepared, and that was called NSPM 13, National Security Policy Memorandum 13, which has since been amended by NSPM 21, just to be clear. And it is classified, but I can share with you what it does in essence is it lays out a process in which we are allowed to do offensive cyber operations and to do it in such a fashion that while the whole of government, other people are aware of it, their ability to get in and to restrict it or to stop it without having a good reason and one that could be basically overcome or changed, this process that we have in place now actually allows us to do offensive cyber operations. It has been successful. And the best example I can give you is that even though Russians and others were able to manipulate information and get into the United States, into our platforms, our software, our social media platforms and so forth with misinformation, when they tried and started to prepare to do that in the 2018 elections, it is not an accident that they were unable to get into the 2018 election cycle and manipulate and provide misinformation and circulate it. It was a significant success for our offensive cyber capabilities, and it was basically proof of concept that doing what we call defending forward was a success. And it is part of what we do right now, which is we engage on a daily basis with cyber operations and those actors that are out there so they know that we are engaged and that we are doing it forward in other areas outside of the United States so that they know that we're watching them and that we are interacting with them to delay their capabilities.
So to my question then, with a Joe Biden presidency, is that going to continue the way that has been successful in the past, or is he looking at making changes, you know, that would be more in line with when he was in office with President Obama?
Remember that so far the individuals that have been approved, such as General Austin, who will now become the Secretary of Defense, I've had good conversations with him, he will follow what the President actually directs, but he clearly understands the need to be able to react quickly within cyber. I've had good conversations with him. And now the issue is whether or not, in an arbitrary move, those in the upper levels of the administration would somehow decide that they want to go back anyway. I think the most significant places that we have to watch are the Department of State, or in some cases they believe that diplomacy versus military activity is the best approach, and we want both, but the one cannot conflict with the other. And so at this point, I think we're in pretty good shape, but we're going to keep our eyes open. We're going to keep our ears open. We continue to ask, as each of these deputy secretaries are confirmed, what their opinion is and whether or not they have a clear understanding of how critical it is that we continue to defend forward and we continue the persistent engagement policies that we have been engaging in for the last 3 years.
Is it, and I hate the word paradigm shift, but there I'm using it, is it kind of a shift that people have to sort of figure out that we are living in a new world of cyber threat and therefore some of those policies have to really, you have to get your mind around them in different ways. Are you finding that? Or are you finding people are having to rethink, you know, how they came up in an area and some of the philosophies that they had now that cybersecurity is the threat that it is in the world?
The professionals who work in it clearly understand it. The challenge is to transfer that into and to gain a political acceptance by those political leaders who will be responsible for a lot of the policy determinations, the strategic policy determinations. At this time, I think because of the broad support we've had in the Armed Services Committee from Republicans and Democrats alike for this policy, I think we're in pretty good shape. And yes, it is true that there is a paradigm shift here, but it's bigger than just cyber. Excuse me. See, it used to be that when we fought and when we had to defend ourselves, we did it based on the domains of air, land, and sea. But now we not only have air, land, and sea, which are domains on their own, but you also have the domain of space and the domain of cyberspace. Both of those are in flux today. They are our adversaries, and then we have them. They are near-peer competitors, Russia and China. Russia has lots of capabilities. China is rapidly developing their capabilities. And they don't have, in many cases, the same concerns that we have about militarizing those other domains. And so we find clear evidence that, you know, our assets that are in space are at risk, and we have to do everything we can to defend those assets. GPS systems are just one example. But we have to defend them from multiple adversaries who recognize our dominance in air, land, and sea, and the fact that we need to defend, and they know that it's less expensive to use cyber weapons than it is to have to build aircraft carriers and stealth bombers. And if they could reduce our ability to be effective by manipulating or reducing our capabilities by using cyber or cyber attacks, then they're going to do it. And so what it amounts to is we just have more to defend, but they, in their capacity, are nearly as dependent as we are on cyber as well. So it's just more area to cover and more places that we are at risk. And remember, a lot of this goes back to what we have to defend in the United States to keep our people safe, and that is we've got energy systems, we've got communication systems, we have financial systems, all of which are critically dependent on cyber. And our adversaries know that. We are the place where huge amounts of assets are found, and because of that, we're the place that they look in terms of trying to either reduce our capabilities or to steal our capabilities.
I want to pivot a little bit and expand on something you just said, but include this conversation about big tech companies. And one of the things that we're seeing even now is the power. You know, you've spoken about concerns about power and dominance of, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Apple and Amazon with data privacy and unfair competition and user agreements that you've said border on censorship or risk being tools of censorship. Now we're also seeing social media used very effectively to impact the stock market in ways that perhaps some people are surprised with. What is your focus right now, Senator Rounds, on big tech when there's so much to really look at? Are all those things connected? Are they separate entities that you need to sort of look at, you know, one at a time? Tell us what your focus is.
Let me put it in a different perspective for just a second. In South Dakota, we've got lots of farmers and ranchers. They're ag producers. They produce beef, they produce pork, and so forth. Today, we have, I think, serious issues with regard to antitrust regarding our packing facilities. You've got four major packers for beef processing. I think the investigations that I believe are going on right now by the Justice Department are very appropriate as to whether or not they are controlling, manipulating the market. They control, those four packers control over 81% of the entire market, and I don't think that's good. I think we have to do things in which to break that up, or at least to separate out and provide for other alternatives, such as smaller meat processing facilities to be able to sell across state lines. So we're trying to do that with legislation, but we've also asked the Justice Department, and President Trump did too, he asked the Justice Department if they would investigate the possibility of price fixing by packers. To the best of my knowledge, that is an ongoing investigation today. Now move that over to the services that we have when it comes to our Internet connections. You've got, and you named a number of them, you've got lots of different organizations that provide services over the Internet, but there's just a couple of major ones, and they have, in some cases, vertically integrated themselves, whether you're talking about the host for a lot of our computer processes where they have huge systems in the cloud itself, Amazon Web Services, Azure Web Apps, Google Cloud, Microsoft, basically. These are all companies that they have huge hardware capabilities that we refer to as the cloud, huge systems. Now, they might very well lease space to other organizations, such as their social media companies, Facebook or Twitter and others. But then you've also got just a series of browsers as well, such as Google Chrome, Safari, Opera, Firefox, Internet Explorer, you know, and some of those. Well, each of those, there's a limited number of them. And the question is, do they have, any one of them, or a couple of them, have they created an oligarchy to where there's a limited number and they control the social media market or access to it? Great example was most recently President Trump was taken off of his Facebook and Twitter. And the question is should they have the ability to do that? Well, that goes back to what the authorities they have to operate in the first place and whether or not in doing so we've created an oligopoly where there's just a few of them that can talk back and forth and make decisions about who they allow on and who they take off and what their obligations are. And so, I mean, we're really getting into some stuff that the Committee on Commerce, the Commerce Committee, really is going to have their hands full in determining whether or not the laws that are in place, including what they call Section 230, everybody's talking about Section 230, whether or not that is still applicable to these major companies, in some cases have already vertically integrated, and whether or not, and my concern, is it time to look at whether or not we should be questioning whether or not there are antitrust activities going on.
So these are connected, but I'm also wondering if they're also separate. And here's what my question is. You know, President Trump's behavior on Twitter, you know, was seen as a violation of their user agreement. That is something that there needs to be accountability and responsibility to. But the question that we're also asking is, should they have such a dominance of the marketplace that when somebody violates a user agreement, which none of us read, because they're changing all the time and they're updating, then are they silenced permanently? Is that kind? Are they two separate in some ways but also connected issues to you? Because we can't disregard someone's behavior on social media either, and you need to be accountable for your words, but is this the right way to hold people accountable for violations of user agreements?
Here's the deal, and we've got to remember, let me just run by this a little bit because I think it'll make some sense. Section 230 is a provision of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. Now, what it says is that companies that operate Internet platforms like Facebook, Instagram, Reddit, Twitter, Yelp, they cannot be held liable for what users post to these sites. Now, these platforms have grown, as you've indicated, over the years, and they've relied on their ability to not be held reliable for the language used in users' posts in order to grow. Now, when these platforms decide to moderate posts, and that's what they've done here, they are even further protected by Section 230's clause, which is called the Good Samaritan Clause, which allows Internet platforms to censor, moderate, or edit content so long as it's done in good faith. Now, not surprisingly, there is no clear definition of what good faith is in Section 230. But by moderating posts, companies like Facebook and Twitter are taking on more of a publisher role. And they need to be able to explain their methods and their reasoning for moderating certain posts. So what they've really done here is granted, they're private companies, so this is not a First Amendment issue when it's a private company. But when they do this and they actually take somebody off and more than one of them does it, is it collusion on their part where they speak with one another? Are they following one another? Or should there be other alternatives out there that are available for someone who is on one and who might move to another? Or do they have to explain in advance what they consider to be their actions in good faith to moderate? And if they do that, should they not be holding other leaders around the world to the same standard? And that really is the issue. What are those standards, and are they playing fair on this, or have they arbitrarily decided to pick on one leader versus another?
The pandemic has been tough on many industries in South Dakota, including tourism and visitor services. And yet, Custer State Park posted record visitation numbers last year, and inquiries from potential visitors are up. As some people dream of a post-COVID travel binge, others are visiting the state now, in the middle of the pandemic, seeking wide open spaces and indoor dining. It's a complicated picture, but Jim Hagan, Secretary of the State Department of Tourism, has navigated challenging markets and dynamic politics before. We talked with him about the state of the industry in South Dakota. Secretary Hagan, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good afternoon, Lori. It feels like it's been about 2 years since we visited, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Good to be on the program. Thank you.
We need that infusion of enthusiasm that only Jim Hagan can bring to our conversations, too, in such difficult times. I want to start with, you know, we can talk about numbers and visitors, but I really want to start with the people who work in this industry in the state, because this has to have been incredibly difficult for them to worry about their jobs, for many to not be able to continue to work or to struggle to go to work safely when visitors do come. So talk to me a little bit about some of the things you've been watching unfold with the business owners and the service workers throughout the state during this really difficult time.
Right. Thanks, Lori. You know, when I think back to last March, which seems like an eternity ago, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As this pandemic was unfolding and as we got into April, things were looking so bleak. If you could have seen my email inbox or had access to my cell phone, the tourism businesses and partners and friends that I was hearing from on a daily basis, it was quite overwhelming, actually. I mean, they were scared for their future, scared for their families, afraid for their employees and what was going to happen. Were we even going to have a tourism season? And the margins for so many of these small businesses are so thin, and they just barely hang on. And so things are bleak. You know, as you looked at it, at the travel and tourism landscape on a national scale, more than half the jobs in the travel and tourism industry disappeared, half, 50%. And in the state, you know, we saw jobs in the travel and tourism sector lead the state in terms of the number of jobs that disappeared. And so those were the realities in front of us. And but as things started to unfold into May, late May and June, there was no question, Lori, given the research that we have access to, really what cutting-edge research, there was a segment of the American population that was still wanting to be inspired and was definitely going to travel. And they were looking for wide-open spaces. They were looking to travel by car because they felt safest in that manner. And so as an industry and as a department, our job was to really relay to our businesses, our tourism businesses, listen, there are folks who are going to come to the state, so we need to do all we can to give them a safe experience while they're here. And so we were pushing on a weekly basis, if not daily basis, health and hygiene protocols, whether those were coming from the South Dakota Department of Health or the CDC, to make sure that those visitors could visibly see safety measures in place and that we were doing all we could to keep them healthy. And so whether you were going into a hotel and seeing sneeze guards and hand sanitizer everywhere, our touchless points of contact, or non-touchless points of contact, the industry stepped up, and that's what they were doing. And so, as a department, all we could do is just make sure that we were relaying information to the industry, like, you know, safety is the new hospitality. That's the new mantra. And so let's do all we can, like I said, to keep them safe. So as things unfolded then through June and July and August, you know, we did see visitation pick up in a pretty good manner. And again, it was those visitors looking for wide open spaces, looking for less populated places. And so when you looked at Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota in particular, we were definitely seeing an uptick in visitation.
One of those challenges then, too, is in that national conversation during that time is about super spreader events and some of the things that you also have to navigate. And you're very good at, saying, we don't check your, we don't check your birth certificate or your political party or your voter registration card at the border of South Dakota. All are welcome. But you're also sort of managing this messaging as well because we're not an isolated state. Tell me a little bit about how some of that communication happened where you say, we're going to make this as safe as possible. We're going to welcome you to these wide open spaces, but we're also going to not be the state that spread things to other states.
Right. When we got to those points where we were having larger events, again, the thing that was in our control, in the department's control, was to have those conversations with our industry, all of our partners. It doesn't matter if you are a restaurant, a hotel, a bed and breakfast, any sort of gift shop. What was in our control is making sure that they knew this was going to be essential. Visitors were going to look for those protocols to be in place. And I believe it was the U.S. Travel Association who did coin that phrase, safety is the new hospitality. And we really took that to heart, and we tried to get the industry, and we're successful in getting them to accept that mantra, too, and to make that their mantra is that, yes, I mean, above all, safety is what we're going to have to provide. And we have to do all we can to make sure, like I said, that we're keeping those families healthy when they're here. One other thing I would add is I'm often asked this, and in fact I was just asked the other day, how long are we going to have these protocols in place and these hygiene measures in place? And frankly, Lori, I don't see that disappearing. I think that's a new expectation for visitors as we look out into the horizon, maybe in perpetuity. That's just going to be another added layer that visitors expect when they come to our businesses. And so much like if you look for a hotel, does it have a swimming pool? Do they have comfortable beds and all those amenities? Do they have safety protocols in place? And I don't see that going away. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm hearing here in Sioux Falls from some people who work in the restaurant industry in places where business is really picking up, and in this case people coming from Minnesota and are just so thrilled and relieved to be able to eat at an indoor, have an indoor dining experience, and some events are coming to town. And I'm asking you this to sort of look forward a little bit because clearly we are not out of this pandemic. I don't want to imply that we are. But I do want to point you to that sense of exuberance and pent-up need and, celebratory someday we'll be vaccinated and we'll be able to do these things. And yet you can't, it's not just going to all go back from an economic standpoint to the way it was. So let's talk a little bit about long-term impact as things have, businesses have closed and employees have moved on to other kinds of work. And then at some point, visitors are already, in some cases, flooding back in, and some places are having a hard time keeping up.
Yeah, that is such an excellent point. And, one of our biggest needs, and it could be the biggest need that we've had in the tourism industry over the last number of years, has been the labor force. We just have not been able to attract the number of workers that so many of our businesses have needed. And to your point now is hopefully as we begin to see light at the end of this tunnel and we work our way back towards welcoming those visitors again and in larger numbers, I believe that's going to be another it's still going to be an issue for us. The labor force is going to be an issue. And so that's one thing, that will always be before us in the years to come. And again, looking at the visitors who will be coming, there is no question that you hit it right on the head, Lori. There is pent-up demand now, and once we get through this pandemic and we're at the point where people are vaccinated and they feel comfortable in traveling again, and we're seeing every week that sentiment is starting to get better now. There's more optimism. People are feeling better about planning. And I just saw data yesterday, and we heard last week at the tourism conference that next July is really kind of the monumental target for so many visitors, saying July 2021 is when we're going to start feeling super comfortable in traveling again if things keep trending the way that they're trending. So, yeah, it's pent-up demand will be there, and with that, again, we'll come the need for labor and all these things. Like I said, that's always been there, but, you know, we'll just have to take it a day at a time, a month at a time, as we ease our way out of this pandemic and things hopefully return to normal.
And as businesses struggle to plan for that, because it's really difficult to say that anything is, you know, a sure thing right now, talk a little bit. We had a change in federal leadership with President Joe Biden. What do we know about the visa, H-2B visas, and bringing people in from other places to support those businesses as employees? What's changed, and what do we just not know yet?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, South Dakotans, whether it be our South Dakota, whether it be in the tourism industry or the ag industry or construction industry, has relied upon H-2B workers and J-1 visa workers. And without those workers, it's a tough row to hoe. And so they have been godsends to this industry. And so I'm not quite sure how things are going to stack up at this point. I think it's too early to tell. But I do know that the U.S. Travel Association, which is the entity that really advocates for all 50 state tourism offices and cities around the country, they have opened up a great dialogue with the Biden administration. And I do believe that the administration has brought back some former Obama administration folks who were very instrumental in growing travel and tourism during those years. So, yeah, we'll see. It's a little still too early to tell, and especially with the pandemic still going on, exactly how those two programs will be affected, the H-2B and the J-1. But we'll see. But I do think once we do get through the pandemic, I do think that there is an appreciation for the new administration that there's a need, especially in rural states like South Dakota.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPV Radio. We're talking with Secretary Jim Hagan of the State Department of Tourism. Secretary Hagan, Governor Kristi Noem in her State of the State address talked about tourism and a new strategic plan and looking for new markets and targeting, in her words, key demographics that have an interest in our parks, history, culture, and great outdoors. You have your finger on this pulse incredibly well. Tell us what some of those new markets might be that she's excited about.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. You know, Dallas, Texas was a new market that we were going to add, but we put a pause on that last March as the pandemic really hit. And so Dallas, Texas is an exciting new market for us. The level of interest there, the number of inquiries coming in has just been exploding over the last 2 years. And so when the time is right, I can't tell you right now whether we'll add Dallas back yet this year, but we're keeping a close eye on it. Chicago continues to explode for us in interest. It's really been a great market for us. We have our staples like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Des Moines, and Lincoln and Omaha, Nebraska. The Front Range in Colorado and Denver have performed really well for us. We're seeing expanding interest in the Pacific Northwest, down into California as well. We're seeing expanding interest in Michigan, in Indiana and Ohio. So it's fun to see it growing both ways, east and west of us. So in terms of our audiences, you know, we really have been fortunate over the last number of years that technology has allowed many entities, including our department, to really target in on our key audiences. And so we'll continue to refine that technology and really hone in on those folks that we know have a tendency to want to visit South Dakota. And that's really based upon their interests. You know, is it state parks, national parks? Is it Native American history and culture? Is it Old West history and culture, pioneer history and culture, all those things? So we're able to get very sophisticated very quickly and reach those people on the right platforms at the right time with the right message. And so we'll continue to refine those, like I said, those technologies, and really just, again, keep it. There isn't a state, Lori, that we couldn't be marketing in. We just, you know, we're fortunate and we're so blessed in this state that we have the state parks, the national parks, the history that is so appealing, and we really are the ultimate road trip state. And so as we do surveys, it's very rare that we find any demographic or any citizen of a state that says, oh, I'm not interested in South Dakota. They're like, of course, I want to go
yeah,
there.
No thanks.
Exactly. So it's fun to see that interest out there and then to slowly expand as our budget may expand a little bit too to begin to cast that net a little wider.
Right. And from a budget standpoint, talk a little bit about that. Will we see long-term impact of, of this crunch on tourism and the visitor industry and the arts, as also part of your purview? Or has the state funding, the federal COVID funding, has that been enough? Is there ongoing need, for congressional support? What do you sort of see as the big picture about COVID relief funding and what you need to keep things moving in a positive direction?
Right. We were very fortunate. The governor really does have her fingers on the pulse of tourism. And so between Governor Noem's support and the legislature's support of providing CARES relief money to the industry, that was a godsend to us, not only at the state level, but to cities as well, to what we call destination marketing organizations, whether it be a group like Experience Sioux Falls or the Lemon Chamber of Commerce. Money was made available to help all of those entities with marketing. So a true godsend, and that's helped a lot, Lori. So I would say year-to-date our budget is down probably somewhere between 12 and 15%, which is not bad considering when I look at what's happening in the rest of the country. Actually, it's really good. And so we'll continue to see how things play out. I know that there's definitely interest and talk in D.C. about another COVID relief package coming through Congress. And so, again, we'll see how that all plays out. But I would say today we're in a much better position than I ever thought we would be last March.
Yeah. So here's a kind of quirky question for you, Jim. when you're sending out messaging, are people responding to South Dakota wide open spaces, the outdoors? Are they responding to indoor dining picture and people are in masks? When you talk about safety, do people want to sort of not think about it when they're engaging with the messaging and just think about things that inherently look safe? Or are they wanting to see openly, like, this is a state that's got it figured out, by seeing people, interact with safety protocols? What messages work?
That's an excellent question. So what we're seeing consumers say is there's no question that they are interested in seeing wide open spaces that they can get out and safely social distance from one another. So that is very appealing. I would say when you bring it down closer to the local level, whether it be a Sioux Falls, a Rapid City, a Yankton, Aberdeen, that consumers are definitely saying that they love and are very open to seeing ads where people are masked up. And so we keep that in mind. It's a combination of both. It seems more at the local level they're wanting to see that safety message. At the state level, we're really pushing our great outdoors, our state parks, our national parks. And we're reminding people, I was just asked this yesterday too, we're reminding visitors that when the time is right for them, that great places will be waiting for them, or great places are waiting for them. We're not hitting them over the head and saying, book now, come now. Our message has always been, when it feels right for you and the time is right for you, we'll be waiting for you. And so we're going to continue with that message. We're going to be very cognizant of consumer sentiment and just really pay attention and be sensitive to what consumers are saying with our message. And I know that all of our local partners are doing that as well.
South Dakota is one of the nation's leaders in distribution and administration of the approved COVID-19 vaccines. Providers say they are poised to do more once more vaccine doses are available to the state. But South Dakotans want to know, when will the federal government provide those doses? South Dakota Secretary of Health Kim Mulsom-Risden returned to the show alongside physician leaders representing three statewide health care systems.
we have South Dakota Secretary of Health, Kim Molson-Risden, with us. Secretary Molson-Risden, welcome back. Thanks for being here today.
Glad to be with you, Lori. Thank you.
Also with us on the phone with Monument Health, Dr. Shankar Kura. Dr. Kura, welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. Happy to be here.
With Avera Health, Dr. David Basil. Dr. Basil, welcome back as well.
Thank you as well.
And with Sanford Health, Dr. Mike Wilde. Dr. Wilde, thank you for being here too.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for having me, Lori.
I want to start with Secretary Molson-Risden and talk about President Joseph Biden has said that he's planning an increased clarity for states about how many doses they will get, an increase in how many doses they will get, and the ordering of 200 million more vaccine doses from the approved manufacturers. Can you tell us if, in your experience working with the federal government, if the communication has changed with the administrations? How does that look from your perspective?
Well, again, we're happy to hear that the federal administration wants to help states have better visibility about what we can expect in future weeks. That's very promising. That gives us more time to plan, and it gives certainly our partners more time to work on the logistics of getting vaccines into arms. You know, time will tell about how effective that is and how much that is borne out, but we appreciate any more information we can get about what our future allocations will bring.
When we look at how South Dakota has been ranked as being more successful than many other states in the distribution and administration, talk to me a little bit about some of the decisions you've made. For example, you know, have you ordered your full allotment for South Dakota every single time it was offered to you? Tell me what's working well.
Well, I can assure you that we've ordered every single dose available. We are poised, as you mentioned in the introduction, to really be vaccinating more people in our state, and I really credit that to our partners, many of whom are on the phone today, and their team's efforts. So we've got a lot of exceptional, dedicated people working together to make sure that we are working across the state, that we are not leaving people behind, regardless of where they live, including in some very rural areas. And so relative to decisions, we have definitely ordered every dose. And I think, or I hope, that the approach that we've taken, which is one of a lot of communication, this is unprecedented kind of work. And so nobody's got a playbook for this kind of stuff. So we work very actively with our partners to make the right allocation decisions, make sure that when we get vaccine to those communities that it can get to people quickly, because we do want to see everything that we get in a week's time, get into shots and arms. So I think our communication has been, we've really worked hard at that. I also feel like we've really tried to be very transparent, and we're going to continue to enhance and put information out on our dashboard and on the covid.sc.gov website so that everybody around South Dakota knows where we're at. On that site, you can look at where your county's at and how many people have actually been vaccinated in your specific county so that, people understand that and hopefully will be in line when it's their time to get vaccinated.
Secretary, I said the other day that if you had told me a couple years ago that we would have a panel discussion and we'd have doctors from Sanford and Avera and Monument all at the same time, all working in collaboration, I might have raised an eyebrow and said, no, they'd probably prefer to be on separate. And here we have seen, at least from the public-facing standpoint, a great deal of collaboration and support of each other. Tell me why that was important to you and what you have seen with these healthcare leaders coming forward and also coming together.
Well, Lori, I just can't say enough about the leadership of our healthcare community in the state. And so I've mentioned before the fact that we can put out a map of the state of South Dakota and say that every county in this state is covered by somebody who's going to take responsibility for making sure the population in that county is vaccinated. In situations where that healthcare partner maybe doesn't have any services, doesn't have a footprint at all, I think that really speaks to the dedication of our healthcare community to do what's right for the population in our state. And I just want to express my gratitude to the folks on the call and our other partners They are, you know, engaging in partnerships with other healthcare community to get the job done, and so I feel really good about where we're at with that. I think, you know, our work on the COVID response in this vein is even before vaccinations, and I think it was somebody just reminded me this week during the legislative session that it was really powerful for them to see us very early in this pandemic when there were so many unknowns and we were very concerned about hospital capacity to talk about the consensus that we were able to reach about the modeling at that point. And so that was very important to people, I think, that they could see us working together, especially in these unprecedented times when there is no playbook and there's no easy answers. So this has been ongoing, and I'm very grateful for it.
I want to ask each one of these doctors about how the sort of behind-the-scenes distribution decisions are made. But first, Secretary Melson Risden, once you place your order and those orders are sent from the federal government to South Dakota, how are you deciding to divide them up between, you know, the trustees of the virus in the sense these three major health systems?
Sure. So what we communicate every week. So we have a standing meeting actually late Tuesdays. We learn what our state's allocation for the following week is going to be on Tuesdays. Sometimes the time of that is a little bit variable, but we meet as a group late on Tuesdays, and that includes all of our phase one vaccinating partners, and we discuss what we know we're going to be getting the following week. And then we discuss where we think the vaccine needs to go based on the numbers of folks that have been vaccinated so far in the priority populations and how many more folks we anticipate needing to be vaccinated. And so we discuss that, and we very frequently discuss, you know, if there needs to be reallocation, if there's, you know, and that's happened several times where we've had people say, you know, I think really what you've got slated for me should be reallocated to this county based on the data. And so I think it's been a very good process so far. And, again, just really using the data to kind of drive where that allocation happens has served us well.
I want to bring in Dr. Wilde first here with Sanford Health. And, Dr. Wilde, if you could talk a little bit about Sanford's efforts, you know, certainly the national news as they've covered the story in South Dakota have shown those Sanford trucks driving, or vans, I guess, driving across the state to rural areas. Once you get your allocation, what happens next?
Yeah, so I appreciate your questions and the information given so far. We've had a very valuable relationship, which some are surprised to always learn that even without pandemic, we actually have a pretty close relationship with our colleagues across the state, whether it's Monument, Avera, or whomever. We want to take care of people, and if you focus on that, we're going to try our best to get that done. We've had a great relationship with Secretary Melson Risden, the Department of Health, the state government. We get that clarity on our doses, and upon getting that within Sanford, we then communicate on where those doses go, whether it's, you know, Sioux Falls or Vermilion or, you know, Winter or, you know, Pier, you name it. We then kind of have our internal plan after we've received clarity from the state of South Dakota on where those should go, and then we work closely with Avera and Monument as well to determine. And so, you know, what makes sense? Do we have good freezer capacity in these locations? Did we cover one area? Do we need to move to another area? Another area has kind of popped up. And so those are day-by-day decisions. And then we set up our vaccine clinics really based on that, based on that week's allocation, to make sure that we can very smoothly get people in. And then we, of course, are notifying people that, hey, we have a dose available. This is how you get it. And so that's really where we take over once we receive communication with the state of South Dakota.
Tell me a little bit, Dr. Wilde, have you ever had extra vaccines? Have you, like, how does, we've always been worried about the expiration date or once things are moving forward. Has that been a challenge at all, that you've had fewer people show up for their doses than expected and you had to pivot?
Yeah, so that's something we're always thinking about. The quick answer is we really haven't, because we've been given flexibility by the state, working closely with Secretary Malcolm Risen, in regard to being able to get enough people invited, because the reality is not everyone we invite is going to come get a dose. And so, but at the same time, we don't want to have a huge population and then have a lot of people frustrated because they're not able to access a dose. And so how do you kind of hit that right spot? But frankly, it's been working pretty well where we have not had extra doses. If we do have extra doses, it's usually in the single digits or maybe double. And we, frankly, have a call list of people that we know could be readily available within the appropriate category as outlined by the state to receive a dose at the end of the day.
Dr. David Basil with Avera Health, anything, first of all, that you want to add to what Dr. Wilde just said there, and any differences or, you know, I guess amendments to how Avera functions once you have an understanding of what your allocation will be for the week?
Yeah, thanks for the question, and I agree, very similar process on our side. And a point that I really want to point out here and not let go by too much is when Kim was talking about how they find out about the number of doses that they get Tuesday mid-afternoon. We meet with the state just right after that and get that information and are able to start acting on that. One of the reasons why, in my opinion, why the state has been so successful in getting so many doses out so quickly is the state's leadership of cutting through all of the red tape, bringing us all together on a frequent basis. And we have, you know, really down in the weeds operational discussions about those things in a very transparent and open manner. And so instead of the state getting some information and sitting on it and digesting it for a couple days and then passing it to us and me sitting on it and digesting it, we just all get together and act on it. And so within a matter of hours, we've all got a game plan that's very consistent between the systems and are ready to move forward. And it's just been working wonderfully, in my opinion.
Dr. Basil, for people who are saying, you know, I want to go to my local pharmacy and get this vaccine just like I would get a flu shot, and they're sort of, you know, feeling a little impatient, tell me a little bit about this using, you know, Avera patient portal and Sanford MyChart and Monuments MyChart and the way that you're communicating with people. How are some of those decisions being made, and will they change if we get significantly larger allotments of the vaccine doses?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question, because the biggest hurdle that we have right now, quite frankly, is just the number of vaccine that we're able to get into the state. And that's the same with every state across the union. We're certainly, I think, getting our fair share. But the number is pretty small given the demand. And so rather than do, say, like a Florida did where it opens it up wide and they just get totally inundated, we've tried to be very thoughtful and keep the categories that are available to be vaccinated relatively narrow at a given time so that it's more of a controlled fashion. And so I think most of the other health systems and us all kind of feel that we could handle a good two or three times the amount of vaccines that are coming into the state on a weekly basis without having to change the structure that we're in right now. As, say, maybe a Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca come on board and that number explodes, we very well may need to look at more of a widespread, bigger vaccination campaign at that time if the numbers greatly increase with the number of vaccine available. But in the short term, there's just not enough vaccine to spread a lot of different distribution points at this point. I do think that the federal retail pharmacy vaccination program will be starting up sometime in February, so we do think we'll see some pharmacies getting some separate allocations and be able to add to the distribution points, but I think it will be a gradual process over time as the amount of vaccine coming in increases.
Dr. Shankakura with Monument Health, you were with us on Monday, and we talked a little bit about this now that we've also heard from Avera and Sanford physician leaders. Anything you want to add to what they're saying, or tell us a little bit, for people who didn't listen to our conversation on Monday, how the rollout process has been going in Western South Dakota?
Lori, first of all, thank you for having us on this panel, and I just want to quickly, you know, kind of agree and add to what was said by both Dr. Wilby and Dr. Basil. Dr. Wilby, you made the good point about the communication with the state. It has been excellent. You know, Dr. Basil about cutting through the red tape and being agile. I want to also thank Secretary Kim Molson-Ryzen for really making this such an amazingly easy process for the health system, for Monument Health. Just like, you know, when we are able to have that conference call on Tuesday, like Dr. Basil said, it makes it so much simpler and very agile. We immediately know what we're getting. The changes are made based on, like Secretary described, based on the county-level data. And then that makes it easy for us to plan. And we have been very fortunate, I would say the state of South Dakota, very fortunate to have such good leadership there to get these vaccines out to us. And then in turn for us, we have locations widespread as Spearfish, Sturgis, Deadwood, Custer, Phillips, Hot Springs, Martin. We got to get these out there. It helps to know what we have and then be able to allocate those in a manner that is expedient. And we've been very lucky to be able to get all of our 1As and 1Cs mostly done. And we have used up pretty much 100%, sometimes even 102% of the doses we received, obviously getting those additional doses out of the Pfizer vaccine. But that has worked very well for us.
Yeah, for listeners who haven't heard that story, this is really about the thrifty use of what was packaged by Pfizer. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. I love that story so much. that some people on the receiving end said, I think we can do better, Pfizer, and they did. Secretary Molson-Ryzen, I want to ask you something that a listener asked us, and this was about how the vaccine is distributed to people above the age of 65, and in other states it's 65 and up already now. In this state, there's more segmenting and looking at 80 people 80 years and older. What can you speak to that quickly about how some of those decisions were made and if they'll change in the days ahead? Will you go down, you know, like 5 years at a time to segment people, or how is the age distinction working in distribution and administration?
Sure, thank you for that, and I'm happy to share some information around that. I think, and you heard this in the other comments earlier, that we really wanted to have a smooth experience for people. And so we knew that the numbers of individuals that would qualify if we just opened it up at 65 and above would be a much larger population than what our weekly allocation would even be able to touch. And so we really wanted to set the expectations appropriately for people so that they would not get frustrated experiencing lack of vaccine if they were in fact eligible to get it. So just to kind of put a couple of numbers out there for you, we know that there's over 36,000 people over age 80 in South Dakota. And so, again, as we are talking with our phase one vaccinators and talking through what we knew of our allocations, we agreed that starting with the 80-plus population made sense based on the allocation that we were seeing, how many people we had in that population. And then also the data around where, you know, COVID really impacts people. And so we know that in particular people over age 80 experience death at the highest rate of all age groups. And so, you know, really I think having a common sense approach to this combined with the fact of what our allocation was is why we decided to start at the 80-plus population. Now, the other thing that we know is that the 1D population is quite large, and so we did anticipate having to kind of divide that group up until we get more vaccines, so that was an expectation going in. The other thing I would add is we do expect to, you know, as our vaccine allocation continues and hopefully increases, once we substantively get through the current population, that we will be dropping that age grouping by 5-year increments. And again, we think that makes sense because, as you've heard some of the folks today indicate, we do have to have a level of flexibility. We can't be so precise that we're leaving doses, unadministered or possibly being wasted. And so we feel that dropping in 5-year increments, so our next group when we get there will be the 75 to 79-year-old age range, will give us that flexibility to, again, get shots in arms.
We're going to take a quick break and come back with more with this panel discussion. When we come back, I'm going to ask you, too, about if we know anything about how IHS and the distribution is happening in our tribal communities, if there's any partnership regarding that. And Secretary Mawson Rice, last time you were with us, you said that our tribal communities had elected all to go with the IHS distribution and to getting their vaccines through the federal pipeline instead of the state. One, has that changed? And two, do you know how that's going? Do you have communications with them? Because clearly we all share the same geography, and getting people vaccinated is really important.
Lori, thank you for that question. So there has not been a change in terms of tribes electing to get their vaccines through the Indian Health Service, and so that remains in place. One aspect of the overall national plan to get vaccines out is that federal entities such as IHS and some others don't necessarily report to individual states. And so that's one thing that, hampers our ability to have, some very detailed information about how vaccination is going. However, again, at the Department of Health level, we have actively worked with tribes throughout the COVID response. And so we have at least weekly communications with each individual tribe to work through everything from testing to PPE and now also, communicate around vaccination efforts. And it's funny that you asked this. I was just asking our folks that are really working with tribes across the state what they're reporting for vaccine take-up, because we really want to make sure that people, again, across the state, if they have vaccine available, that they are, getting in line and getting vaccinated, and hearing really good reports about that. And so we're not hearing of big issues with vaccine hesitancy, and so that's good news. The other kind of work that we've done jointly is really around communications and making sure that tribes across the state have the most updated information from the state level about the COVID response, and that they're able to share that information with their members. But don't have that detailed, kind of numbers around vaccines quite yet, and we're hoping that we'll see some improvement in that in the future.
Dr. Basil, would you add to that when Secretary Mawson Rice talks about hesitancy? One of the things that I've seen are people, which it seems like a very South Dakotan thing to do, saying, I think someone needs this more, and I'm going to, pass on my turn until there's more availability. What are you seeing with vaccine hesitancy and our sort of compliance or acceptance numbers or percentage rate? And your message to people who are conflicted about whether or not they should take their turn in line or whether they should wait?
Yeah, thank you, Lori. And we have seen just that, where we've had physicians who have said, I'm not comfortable getting vaccinated until my most at-risk patients are vaccinated. And we've had to have some of those discussions with them that you're not going to be able to do your patients any good if you're sick. And so, physician, heal thyself kind of first a little bit. And so we have had that. In general, I would say that I've been very pleased and humbled by the vaccine acceptance rates in the best population that we have insight into is our own frontline healthcare workers, and it's been over 75% of those that have been getting the vaccine after we've offered it to them, and more are signing up every day as we go forward. And another population where it's been incredibly good uptake has been in the nursing home residents, and we've seen in general, rates above 90% in our nursing home because those residents have really seen the impact it can have on other people in the building, and so they've been very welcoming of the vaccine. So not nearly as much vaccine hesitancy as we were afraid there might be. In general, people are just so grateful and thankful to be offered.
Dr. Wilde, if you want to add anything to that from a Veris perspective, please do so. And also I'd add the question for you, are you seeing, misinformation campaigns, or how has the messaging been in South Dakota so people understand the facts behind this vaccine? What have you been seeing?
Yes, I would agree with Dr. Basil. From a Sanford standpoint, our numbers are really quite similar. We, too, were very pleasantly surprised. surprised and frankly really excited about the uptake within the nursing home population, which is really inspiring and really just that excitement out there to everyone. I think you described it very well, Laurie, in regard to hesitation. It's that South Dakota attitude of, you know, put someone else in front of me. And really my message, because I feel the same way, but really my message is if your number's up, get the vaccine, absolutely. In regard to information out there, I think all of us, including COVID.sc.gov, SanfordHealth.org, we all have information, including some frequently asked questions around the vaccine. And I would ask you, that's by physicians for and our experts for the state of South Dakota and anyone who looks at that site. We're trying our hardest to get the truest information out there regarding this vaccine. Our motives are not ulterior. Our motives are simply to get patients, or excuse me, to get people vaccinated. We really want to see this as a way to get out of this pandemic. That's exciting. It's been a long time, and there's hope out there. So please consider the vaccine. But if there's education available out there through the sites that I listed, and I think the state, I think we have really tried to do a good job shifting some of our marketing away from our specialty care to our primary care to say it's okay to get care, it's okay to get vaccinated, and to really try to get some confidence out there that we do feel that this is safe. And a case in point is I think we're close to about 90% of our physicians have been who have been offered the vaccine have accepted it. Those that haven't maybe have been you know, what we call kind of locums or just here briefly, but otherwise there's been great excitement within, I'd hope to say the experts within our area to accept this vaccine, and would really encourage people that as you get an opportunity, get vaccinated.
Dr. Kura, I have a question for you from a listener here who lives in Rapid City, 65 years old, was given an appointment from Monument, and then that appointment was canceled due to CDC guidelines, wondering why that would happen when other friends, this person believes, who were younger and healthier, received the vaccine. Why would an appointment be canceled? Any thoughts on that? I know that's hard to answer when it's...
good question, yeah. Lori. But before I answer that question, just wanted to add my own thoughts for the previous question. I think what Dr. Lobey and Dr. Basil said, we had similar experiences the South Dakota way of, but we have had a similar kind of excitement to get the vaccine, and when folks finally were in line, they got it. And so the good news is the uptake has been very good. So to answer that question from the listener, when we first launched out our online quick link to schedule a vaccine, there was a mistake in the software itself. Some of the questions had to be revised and corrected. So they were not the folks that unfortunately got that. We actually reached out back to them to inform them that they were not in line to get the vaccine yet. So we have fixed that. There was an error quite early. That's no longer the case. That was the very first day we launched out that. It's a bot that comes up, and you answer a few questions, and then you're provided the spot to get yourself scheduled. So unfortunately, that happened. My apologies from the health system. But we fixed that pretty quickly, and from here on should be a clean process.
We just have about a minute left, and this is comment really is for all of you, extending thanks to Secretary Malsom-Reisen, her staff, and to the people in the medical system for handling the process. I'm sure you've had many sleepless nights from the first diagnosis to now. Vaccination process not easy, but some gratitude coming in from listeners now via email as well. And we have like 30 seconds left, Secretary Malsom-Reisen, and I want to give that to you because the mitigation efforts are far from over. What do you want people to do and to know now about still fighting back against the spread of this virus as we wait for more vaccines from the federal government?
Well, you're spot on, Lori. We are not out of the woods yet, so we need people to continue to do what we've asked them to do. Stay away from others, especially in indoor settings. Wear masks when you can't. Wash your hands often. Practice good hygiene. And just be mindful of the things that are important towards slowing that spread. If you have symptoms, or you've been exposed to somebody with COVID, please get tested. We have free at-home testing available. Go to covid.sd.gov. Order your test today. It's easy. You'll send it back. There's no cost to you. So we need to continue to practice the things that we can do individually. We need to continue with testing efforts to really box COVID in. Get vaccinated when you can. And I also just want to make another pitch, Lori, if I might.
Very
quickly,
yep. In
addition to our great partners, we have the Mobridge Regional Hospital and then our Northern Plains network of hospitals really helping with vaccination, and they've been doing exemplary work as well, and I'm grateful for them.
For many South Dakotans, time outdoors has been essential to living a full life during the pandemic. With the recent retirement of Secretary Kelly Hepler, Governor Noem has named Kevin Roebling as interim secretary for the Game, Fish, and Parks Department. We talked with Roebling about legislative priorities for the department.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, Lori. Happy to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about legislative priorities for the session this year. Is there anything you want to lead with?
Oh, I think it's just continually promoting the great outdoors. You know, it defines who we are as South Dakotans. Really, it just contributes greatly to the quality of life, and we're so very proud to offer those great opportunities, especially, you know, an escape from the pandemic. I was just listening to your previous session, and that's what the outdoors have been, and that's going to be the focus going into session as well, making it easier for youth participation, for youth to engage in hunting in particular, focusing on customer experience, customer satisfaction, all those great things that the Game Fish and Parks is very proud to be a part of, absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard to, I mean, if you ever took it for granted before, you probably don't anymore after going through especially some of those early months and watching what people across the country went through without access to some of these spaces. We have seen increased visitation for places like Custer State Park. Have you seen any challenges with the number of people who have been perhaps using services for the first time?
You know, it has been a phenomenal year, and thanks to Governor Noem and her leadership for keeping the outdoors open. Like you just mentioned, there's other states in the country that closed their fishing seasons, closed their campgrounds, and we kept things open, and people came, and people escaped. You know, the challenges, sure. I mean, we've seen about 6.5 million visitors last year, and this year over 8.2 million. It was a great year. Visitation was up 29%, reservations were up 24%, and we did it all with a very limited staffing. We actually didn't hire our seasonal staff to the level we used to just because of the uncertainties of COVID early on in that May period. So it was an all-hands-on-deck approach, and staff did a phenomenal job taking care of the facilities, taking care of the parks, you know, just the day-to-day management, the operations. I hope folks that did come to the park system did experience greatness. I sure did. I traveled around the state myself and my family and got to experience the great outdoors and utilize those services as well. And it was fantastic. The memories made there were top-notch, and we really, really are fortunate to, you know, provide those excellent opportunities to the residents and non-residents that come visit.
Yeah. I want to talk about a few things Governor Noem mentioned in her State of the State address, and one was the importance of the bounty program. She said over the past 2 years, nearly 4,300 people participated in the Nest Predator program, removing roughly 81,000 nest predators, and that program is just getting started. Tell us a little bit about balancing an ecosystem. When do you know that the ecosystem is balanced?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, obviously the focus is on nesting birds, and in particular pheasants and waterfowl. And, you know, there's a lot of data and science out there suggesting that if you trap at high intensities, at localized levels during the primary nesting season, you can enhance and influence nest success. And that's the hope of the program. The other hope of the program is to really get youth engaged, youth involved. You know, we did remove 81,000 nest predators I would say that was a fraction of what's out there, and the vast majority did come from eastern South Dakota. You know, 93% of the tails submitted did come from the eastern part of the state, with the major counties being Minnehaha, Yankton, Turner, Beetle, Brookings. So that is the primary area of our nest, of our pheasants and our waterfall nesting that does occur across South Dakota. So it's good to see. We have no concern right now as far as an ecosystem balance. There's plenty of nest predators out there to still be removed, and we're going to keep removing those nest predators into the future.
Governor also said that anecdotally, pheasant numbers are through the roof. What can you tell us about brood count and what we know about the pheasant population right now?
Oh, yeah, great question. And actually, I mean, pheasant hunting has been really phenomenal. I've been hunting public land myself here and there with my new pup. And, you know, there isn't a day that goes by that you don't kick up roosters in places that you used to not kick up roosters. So that's just been a testament to the overall bird numbers. Getting a lot of solid reports from the field, where there's grass, perennial grass, there's birds. Where there's cattail, you know, marshes, wetlands, complexes, there seems to be birds. They're holding thick into that cover. But overall, the reports have been very solid, up and down, east to west, north to south. Hunters have been finding success in the field. Our conservation officers have been finding successful hunters. It has. It's been a great year. And this winter should set us up for another great year, really. If we continue the mild winter we've been seeing, the open winter in a lot of places, that does help overwinter survival. And we're hopeful that will contribute then to a great hunting season in 2021 as well.
Yeah. There used to be an official count. Is there still an official count or not?
So in August, the brood survey was conducted. It ran from August 1st to August 15th, and this was the first year we haven't conducted a brood survey for quite some time, and we suspect we won't be conducting another brood survey in 2021 as well. You know, weather is a real driving factor in bird production, and we've got some incredible biologists that are putting winter severity indices together that correlate very strongly with survival, overwinter survival. And then what drives things in the spring is spring precipitation models. So between those two covariates, I mean, we have a pretty good handle on as to what we should expect for pheasant populations to be. And Mother Nature really does. It is what drives a lot of production, pheasant production across the state. So we're utilizing those models and getting a good idea as to what we should expect on the landscape come fall.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the extended youth pheasant season and what do people know, especially if this, they're maybe new to pheasant hunting and are trying to either mentor youth or, you know, enter a field that they haven't seen before. Help them get started.
Yes, that has been the focus. The focus is on the next generation, and it really hits home for me with 3-year-old twins at home and a 1-year-old. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about youth participation and youth hunters. And that's exactly the focus of our commission, the focus of Governor Noem, and the focus of this department is to focus on that next generation. The youth pheasant season is just that. I mean, it does. It allows more opportunity for youth hunters to engage in the great outdoors, engage in, you know, spending time with their families, pheasant hunting. And we have youth seasons across many different seasons. There's youth seasons for deer. There's youth seasons for waterfowl, small game, like we just mentioned. And those are great standalone opportunities for the youth to kind of get the first crack at the critters on the landscape. So that's what that's all about. It's to focus on that youth participation. And we're trying to make it easier for youth to participate, trying to streamline the dates for youth participation so anybody under the 18 would be considered a youth hunter. And really just making it, we have the example I always use. We have 6 pages in our hunting handbook that explain youth participation, eligibility, and requirements. We're trying to get those 6 pages down to 2 to streamline those ages and those dates and just make it way easier. Reducing those participation barriers is a real focus for the department.
Okay, so as a dad, obviously you're busy, clearly, and, you know, what are some of the first, you know, 3-year-old too young to walk the field with you, but what are some of the ways that you start with some of those early ages to invite them into, you know, just the world with the person in their family, whether it's dad or mom or both or whomever who hunts. When do you start having those conversations, and what are some of the early experiences with hunting that kids might have?
Oh, excellent question. And actually, I have taken my three-year-olds hunting quite often, and they ride on my back, and I put earmuffs on them, and they love it.
Okay.
Eagle pheasant hunting is probably my son's favorite statement. So it's never too early. Never too early to engage youth in outdoor participation. And my family's an testament to that for sure. You know, I think a lot of it is just exposure. Exposure to create whole families, whole outdoor families to engage in those types of activities. You know, our focus is not just on youth, but trying to get mom involved, dad involved, and creating those whole family events and activities are critical to retention of participation. You know, we can recruit new users, but we want to keep those new users, you know, into the future. And that's a big focus there is whole family participation. So anytime we can, you know, have events or have like a hunting 101 course, we really stress to bring mom and dad into the classroom as well to carry on that hunting and trapping or fishing tradition. And never too early to start. There's programs and things within our outdoor campuses in Sioux Falls and Rapids. There's educators across the state that wear the Game Fishing Park shirt that each and every day that's their goal, creating whole families, recruiting the next generation, and to ensure we have folks engaged in the great outdoors.
We have been talking a lot on this show and, you know, throughout the SDPB airwaves about the Department of Environment and Natural Resources merging with the Department of Ag. People have been asking questions about conservation and environmental protections and how that also intersects with GF&P. What can you tell us about the merger of those two departments in the sense that, you know, how does Game Fish and Parks work with those departments already and how will that change once the merger is complete, if it is complete?
Yeah, no, and there's a lot of interaction that already occurs with the Department of Ag and the Department of Natural Resources in the past. Now being merged, they'll continue those relationships and those partnerships and the collaboration amongst those, you know, those different departments. As far as conservation goes, I mean, producers, landowners, they define that word conservation. Sustainability is a huge part of their operation, and they're going to do what's best for the land to ensure that land is available for future generations as well. So we all have the same goal in mind, and that's sustainability, and conservation is a big part of that. And we're going to continue working with our partners, both in Ag and in Department of Natural Resources, DANR is what we call it now, Ag and Natural Resources, you know, to ensure water quality, to ensure all those great things that were being conducted in the past will still be conducted, and we're excited to do so.
That has been the criticism, that those two don't always go in hand, that sometimes profitability has to trump conservation. Do you think that that's true?
Oh, no. There's definitely a balance, and the department, both departments will strive to find that balance, and the Game Fishing Parks will be a part of those conversations, and I see this playing out very well into the future. And really, it comes down to the collaboration of sustainability and profitability and balancing all of the above. And it's a great move and a great merger, and we're excited to be a part of it.
You were a part of figuring out the non-meandering waters legislation in years past. Are there any updates on that and how that is working for landowners and anglers throughout the state?
Yes, another somewhat contentious issue can be at times, and it has been working very, very well. You know, as far as the 250,000 acres of publicly accessible non-meandered waters in the state, only around 5,000 of those acres are closed. So a very small fraction of the open, accessible acres compared to what is closed. It's working very well. One thing we continually stress is recreate with respect, and that is so critical. We want to ensure that, you know, the recreators out there, the fishermen, the anglers, are respecting those producers. They're respecting the landowner, you know, the property rights, you know, parking off the roads and those sorts of things. We have had a few issues here just recently with parking on roads. The ice is not in great condition, so people can't drive on the ice like in normal January months. Typically, you'll see, you know, the vehicles out on the lake, not on the side of the road. And so we're just asking anglers to really recreate with respect, making sure semis and things like that can get down those roads and those producers, those landowners can continue their day-to-day.
Yeah. Before I let you go, say more about the conditions of the ice so that people hear that message loud and clear for personal safety. What are you seeing, and how should people do things differently in response?
Yeah, the ice is it's very variable, I guess is the best way to put it. I was just out trying to take my three-year-old ice fishing yesterday, and before I did so, I obviously checked the ice, and where the ice was good just 2 weeks ago, it wasn't so good yesterday, so we decided not to go. And we got to really proceed with caution when it comes to the ice, because conditions, once the 50 degrees hit and those nights stay above freezing, the ice deteriorates very quickly. We've had a tough year. Our conservation officers had some tragic events occur. We just ask folks to really be cautious on the ice, especially driving out, especially with UTVs, ATVs. Foot traffic's always the best if there's any doubt. But make sure folks are checking the ice continually, even if there's places that you've been out this year already. So one of those things, we can't be cautious enough. Conditions when it gets into these temperature ranges can be very variable and change very rapidly.
From nation-to-nation relations to disaster relief, from filling potholes to feeding hungry school kids a nutritious meal, the role of government is about far more than lawmakers arguing on the State House floor. And although we may disagree on the latest trending issues on Twitter, we mostly agree that decision-makers we entrust to represent us have significant influence and responsibility. And that means there's value in taking time to get to know them, and in holding them accountable for their words and their actions.